This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Keith Clark.
Yes.
And I'm Jane Bolton.
I'm Leslie Clark.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Keith, were you born in the Manawatu area?
No, I was born in Richmond, Nelson. My dad was a cheese and butter maker, and my mother was a psychiatric nurse, but I had quite a background of grandfathers there as well. My grandfather lived in Belgrove, and my other grandfather and grandmother lived in Rewalker. So I had a base in Nelson. In fact, my early ancestors arrived in Nelson in 1842.
Oh, very early.
He was an explorer and surveyor. And there's a Clark Valley and a Clark Mountain and a Clark River named after him, because he found the way to the Buller.
Yeah.
And
They were among the very original European
Nelsonians, yes. Okay. And they brought five daughters with them on the boat.
Okay.
And of course they
got on very well with the local Maori.
Yes, they did. Yeah. The Maoris helped them tremendously in the early stages.
Okay.
And in fact, my great-great-grandfather could speak quite a bit of Maori at the time.
And so what was the... Because there was some conflict with the Maori.
Yes, there was conflict over... more particularly in the Blenheim, Mulberry area.
Ah, okay.
Warra Massacre was part of that sort of time. But the access in those days was through Lake Rotuiti and down the Rainbow, and then that was access to Canterbury through the rivers down through there.
Okay.
Just over the
Wanganui. Yes. So it was a fascinating sort of... at one stage, some of the family had the hotel in sort of at Lake Rotuiti.
Okay.
And so...
Top house,
yes. Ah! Yes.
Ah,
yeah, they they were one of the early owners of that.
Hmm.
Anyway, from... there, from Nelson, Dad got a job in Karamea. So the mixed stage of my life was in Karamea, and I was there till I was about nearly seven. Had some fascinating times in Karamea. It was a place where you measured whitebait by the kerosene tin.
And,
so...
And was that for your own consumption? Or
yes. Or it was used as a fertiliser a lot of the time. And then it was a little community where I can have fond memories of going eeling and catching my first flounder. And
so you're talking about what sort of time it is, the 1940s, 1930s?
It would be about 32 or 33 or something like that, somewhere about there, 35 perhaps.
Yeah, okay.
And I remember Kingsford Smith coming and landing on the beach, and my parents went for a short round and back down again, ride with him at that stage. I was too scared to go, I wouldn't go.
Yeah.
I also remember my first day at school. I started at 6, and I wouldn't go without my bow and arrow. And the first interval, the big boy, he must have been about standard 1 or something, you know, one of these boys, beat me up. And I got very wild and went inside, got my bow and arrow, and planted him with a toy arrow, you know. Well, I got a terrible hiding from the infant mistress at the time, yeah. And I got another one when I got home and lost my bow and arrow. So that was a terrible disaster.
Well, highly memorable.
Well, from Karamea, we then, when I was seven, we went to Arahura, Hokitika area and West Coast. And for the next part of my life, I lived in on the West Coast. We lived at Arahura right through the... I was a boy during the Depression and then the war. And towards the end of it, Dad moved down to Harihari. So I had an extension of my time on the coast there, looking more at the glacier end of the coast rather than the other end. I grew up with a very independently. I was sort of the only boy for about 2 miles or something all round. So, and my grandfather's taught me very early on guns. So by the time I was about 10, I shot my first deer. And I was...
Good job they waited that long, otherwise he might have taken your rifle to school.
Yes, but it was a time when you had to look after yourself, your families. And it was interesting that from today's point of view, like this countdown sort of, everybody... looked after each other. So if you had a few extra eggs, you passed them on. If you shot a deer, you gave them some steak. You had extra garden vegetables, you passed them on. So it was like that, and we had no power.
Was that it was a small stable community, the same people that you'd known for a long time?
Well, we were newcomers. Dad was the dairy factory manager at the time, so but we got to know the farmers all around very quickly because they used to come in the morning. It was great. In the morning they would come with their wagons and horse and drays and things like that, and drop their cream off.
Was that a sort of cooperative dairy factory?
Yes.
So you're sort of employed by the farmers, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yep. And Dad was probably New Zealand's best butter maker. He got medals and cups and the lot. And he continued to do that all the time. So it was an interesting life. We're in an area where there are a lot of wild game, rabbits, hares, ducks, trout, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And so we had to really look after ourselves.
Did you need licenses and things for that? Trout fishing?
We usually took a duck shooting license out every year, but that was about the limit of it. It was very, you had to learn pretty early how to feed yourself. I had, my grandfather gave me a beautiful Springer Spaniel, which became my hunting dog. And we had two others as well, a Fox Terrier and another little dog. And they were made a hunting pack for rabbits and things like that, so... Okay. It was a very, very busy life for a young person because, unlike today, we had all sorts of chores to do. You know, it was my job always to do the kindling and get wood in for the fire also to clean shoes and things for Sunday church and all kinds of... bits and pieces that I had to feed the hens, get the eggs in. So there was
Were you an only child? Did you have any siblings?
I had my mother was a diabetic and she had several miscarriages. I was the only child until we had a sister. I had a sister late in life, and she lives now in Palmerston North here too.
Oh, good. So you had to do all the chores, really?
Yes, yes. Yes. And we went to town about once a month. It was during the war, and so we were rationed.
Yeah.
And so petrol was rationed, ammunition was rationed, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then there were soldiers, a lot of the young men in the valley left for the war. And so I was one of the few young fellows in the area, and the farmers got overrun with a lot of the small game stuff, rabbits, ears, rubbish, all that sort of thing. So they would give me ammunition to go and shoot on their farm and get rid of some of the game that was there.
Okay.
Deer as well later on. Hmm. So from about 10 to 15, I had a wonderful life up in the hills and mountains that sort of life.
So where did you go to school? You went to high
I went to a little school called Kaihinu, and that was part of the Maori population school there. The Maoris used to come to the school.
So, were most of the pupils Maori?
Half and half, around about that.
And how did they just treated each other?
We were just friends, yes. And one of the interesting things at the time was that the kamatua of the pa there came along, and he told the headmistress at the time, "Look, I do not want my children to speak Maori at school." He said, "I want my families to grow up learning English so they can get an English job, working, in other things." So that was a sort of interesting sort of part of my...
But they would all be speaking Maori at home?
At home. And English, they could. So, interesting. They taught me a lot of things, these Maori children. They were very good at eeling. They taught me how to make bobs for eels, where you had flax and worms on the end of the flax fibre on the end of a pole, and you put that in
with hooks?
No hooks. So the eels would come and bite at the worms, but get their teeth caught in the fibre, and you'd go flip like that, and they would come over. Sometimes they'd hit you in the face as they came over. And they taught me how to do a few other things too. They used to make little ovens and how to throw stones with what they call a claddy stick, long piece of flax, claddy with a push in the end of it. You'd push a stone in and you'd go flip.
Oh, yeah.
And that stone would probably go 100 metres without any trouble. So we had lots of good friends that way. It was interesting growing up in just a small school like that. I didn't really start school till I was about 7. Even though I had that episode in Karamea, but at 7, I started this Kaihinu, and somehow or another I learned to read and write very quickly. They pushed me through. So I jumped standard 2 and I jumped form 1 on the way through. So I was at high school in Hokitika by the time I was 12.
Would that be quite unusual?
It was unusual,
And so you were then there with much older...
Oh, much older children.
Was that difficult?
Yes, it was socially quite difficult. And that's why I'm making sure that my great-granddaughters and children don't get pushed through school.
Yes.
Obviously I could cope academically, but it was a social and physical.
Does the issue now with gifted children is that do you push them forward or do you broaden them out?
Yes, well, that's my philosophy now is that they should be broadened out.
Yeah.
But they didn't have the opportunities in those days to do that, so we just had to stick to, you know, I'd passed, I think in Form 4 I passed the public service exam. Mm. In Form 5 I passed UE and school certificate. Mm. I finished school by 15.
Yeah.
Did you matriculate in those days?
Yes. Yeah. And so I loved school, it was good.
Yeah.
I had to bike 6 miles to school each morning and back again at night. So, and I got, pretty handy on a bike. Although there were episodes when I came off and had gravel rash and all sorts of things.
Sort of roads was it?
Gravel roads.
Flats or hilly or...?
No, it was flat, pretty flat all the way.
So
here. And it was interesting. It was during the war, through that latter part, and we had a school army unit unit.
Yeah.
I became a sergeant in that, and I was classified as a marksman. Mm. By the army, who used to come in and help us, and they used to use me to... I used to love this. They used to take me for a week up into the area where there were the places to shoot, and I would bang away at targets all day for a week.
Okay.
They had... American rifles came in for the Home Guard.
Mm.
And they were old rifles, and they, some of them were not very accurate at all. And so it was my job to fire 3 shots.
Mm.
And if they targeted well, they kept the rifle, and then there was an armourer with me, and he would adjust the sights. So I'd fire another shot, and if it was okay, it went into the truck again, and otherwise they would if it wouldn't group at all as a rifle, then they would scrap it. But it was a fascinating time, because they also used to say to me, well, I got to know the men very well, sergeant and so on, and he would say, would you like a rifle and 10 rounds of 30-06 for the weekend? And I'd used to be able to get a deer for him and give him a haunch of venison on the Monday or something.
Right.
So you were about 15 or 16 at the stage?
15. We expected the Japanese to be...
Yeah.
In fact, they'd been sighted, a sub had been sighted off the coast, and they thought they might land somewhere there. So I had a Bren gun squad.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but 15-year-old with a Bren gun... 2,000 rounds of ammunition available all the time, and a place up on the hill above Hokitika where I could sight the coast. So
you had it all ranged and everything?
I had 3 other boys. One on magazines and one to change the barrels for me when needed. It was very unusual for that time, but then it was wartime.
You must have been very responsible as well, though, from the experience you'd had.
Well, I got pushed into responsibility a lot. My dad had been a sergeant in the Territorials, and he wanted to go to the war, but they wouldn't let him because he was a butter factory manager and in charge of all that sort of thing. So he was in charge of the Home Guard. So I also joined the Home Guard while I was there, learned to march with them and all sorts of things. Oh. It was.
So how realistic is the Dad's Army TV program?
Very, very realistic, yeah. Except we had wooden... we had broomsticks sometimes for guns and things like that. They took all our guns away from us, the big guns. They were all confiscated at the time.
Okay.
The last year, between 15 and 16... one of the men in the factory hurt himself with his leg, broke a leg and all sorts of things, and they couldn't get other people quickly, so they... I was really well trained in the dairy factory because I used to get up with Dad at 5 o'clock in the morning quite often and help him get the first load of butter off. So I got taken out of school to work in the factory with permission of the school and everybody. And so I worked for something like 6 months or more. I used to work in the factory till round about lunchtime, then I'd bike to school and I'd do the afternoon at school. So that was a pretty busy time for me. And they gave me a higher... school gave me a higher leaving certificate. At the end of that year, and so I'd earned some money which had been put in the bank, and I had enough money to go to Canterbury University next year. So that was... here was I at 16 at Canterbury University, staying with...
was that still during the war? Or
yes. Okay. It finished 1945, finished the year I was there. So, but unfortunately, it wasn't good for me. I got, through my own fault, three of us went hunting during the May holidays away up in the mountains behind the Arahura River, right up the Arahura River, which works across the Lake Canary. So we were right up in that region, in the Greenstone region. And we went on horses, and it rained, poured. We got very wet. We had to swim the rivers with the horses, and I got very ill. Afterwards, I got flu and sort of pneumonia, and then I got nephritis, and they didn't expect me to live. And so for 7 months, I was in hospital during that time. And, of course, that finished all my... university thoughts at the time, and because I was aiming to be a research scientist. I'd done very well in maths and physics and chemistry, so that was the where I aimed at that time to go. Out of hospital, home in Harare at the time, and we... had Mum and Dad were pretty worried about me still, and so they sent me up to Auckland, to Murray's Bay, where my grandmother was living at the time. And she had a lovely section there right next to the sea, and so she looked after me for about 3 months over the winter.
So you're just recuperating then?
Yes, she fed me up, and I used to go down, paddle in the sea, and pick strawberries up in the valley, and do all sorts of things like that while I was there. And then I had three uncles up there as well. They were all tied up with the railways. He was... one was assistant manager of railways, another one was transportation... a superintendent, another one managed all the timetable for trains throughout New Zealand. So they used to take me with them sometimes, and I used to be, you know, up in the head office there with them and see all the complications of what was happening with the railways. And I met some of my first cousins up there, and I'm still good friends with those that are still alive. So... We had three interesting months up there, and then it warmed up the summer, and I was feeling much better. So back I came to Harry Harry, and they, by then the factory had a little job for me. I was a sort of a storeman and account writer and all that sort of thing in the main office there. When the farmers would ring up and say, "Oh, could I have an extra bag of wheat, please, or two bags of potatoes, or Weet-Bix, or whatever, oil, or petrol, or whatever it was," and I would then organise that and put it on their account, and when the lorry came in the early morning, we'd load the lorry up, and that would go out with those sort of supplies as it collected cream on the way back. So, so that was interesting for a few months, and then the chance came up to apply for a teaching position. I thought, well, gee, I think I could probably do that.
And so there was no training required for that at that stage?
Yes, you needed to train.
Oh, okay.
But well, as it happened, I didn't. They turned me down because they didn't think my health could stand up to the rigours of teaching. But they said, "We have we think you're quite capable, but we'll give you an opportunity if you can get through next year. We'll look at you again very positively." And they gave me a grade one school to look after for a year. It was at
a whole school.
Yes, Terramcal Settlement, with nine children.
So they said that they don't think you can cope as a teacher, but we'll put you in sole charge of the school.
With nine children. And so for 1 year, this was it was quite remote.
Did they give you a lot of resources, teaching materials?
No. I had about 2 weeks over at Canterbury Teachers College, and they sent me out to a very small school close by, and I worked with that teacher for about 2 weeks, learning some of the basic things that I needed.
Yeah.
And then I rode my bicycle into this remote school about 16 miles from Coomara.
And you were about how old then?
I was, I'd have been about 17 then.
Okay. And what did the community think of us, an unhealthy 17-year-old with no training but in charge of this?
And what's more, I had to stay each term with one of the parents in the area. They were all small farmers in the area, sheep, mostly dairy, but some sheep. And so I had a fascinating year, and it was certainly a tight learning curve.
Because you'd have all the administration of the school and budgets everything.
And I had children from I had one new entrant right up to Form 2. So the Form 2 taught me probably as much as anything about how to run the school initially. And so
You learnt as much as that in any teacher training anyway.
Yes, it was quite interesting really the year, because we got on very well as a sort of a little group. So I was able to sort things out, the basics for them, and I taught them to read. In fact, one of the boys was what we would call just not quite average. And I spent a lot of time with Joe, and Joe was a nice fellow, nice young man in a big family. And later on, in later years, Joe turned up, found me again when I was living in Blenheim. Well, Joe said, you know, you taught me to read. And he said, I got a job on the dredge.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to work on the stacker on the dredge, and I pushed a red button and a green button. But he said, in between time, I read all the time, read all these books and things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he was earning about half as much again as I was as a teacher at the time. So mm-hmm. it was quite
well done, very well.
But anyway, we had a lovely little group. There were about half a dozen, I suppose, young
mm-hmm.
people, girls and boys in mm-hmm. the valley,
mm-hmm.
about somewhere about my age. So mm-hmm. we used to have a monthly get-together.
Mm.
In the school,
yeah.
using an old gramophone records for dancing,
mm.
and we'd try and dance, and the girls had to cook. We had to have a meal, and it was up to the men or the young fellows in the area to get something to eat that night. Mm. So we either had to go and get a trout somewhere or a bit of venison mm-hmm. or something like that, and I'll tell you what, it was a highly illegal process because we used to get a horse
mm.
and ride along the stream sort of parts of the river
mm.
and when we saw a trout in the water, there would be a bang and the old, what they'd call a nickel spinner used yeah. to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd bring a trout home, and the girls had to cook that, and then they'd also made a pie or something like that. So that was part of it. So it was an interesting year, something like that.
Okay. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.